May it please the court. My name is Will Edson, and I represent William Meyer in this appeal. I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal. Great. This case resulted in a six-day bench trial between two neighbors. After the trial, Judge Urich awarded my client $150 and found that there was a de minimis trespass. Judge Urich also awarded the Galvins, the counterclaimants below, approximately $73,000 in damages under RCW 424-630. And he also awarded them approximately $69,000 in fees and costs, quote-unquote, pursuant to RCW 424-630 and CR 11. I'd like to start with the damages. If this court agrees with Meyer's arguments on the damages, there's no need to address the fees. Starting with the $10,000 award, the court may remember this related to Mr. Meyer's alleged placement of certain pavers on the what the Galvins alleged was their property. But the evidence at trial was undisputed that the property was actually the county's right-of-way. It's true that the Galvins had a revocable encroachment permit, but they didn't obtain this permit, and the evidence shows this, until after Mr. Meyer placed the pavers on the property. Therefore, under Cowell, which the whole premise of the statute, Cowell says, is that it has to be an invasion by the plaintiff on the, or the defendant onto the plaintiff's property.
But wasn't leaving them there and refusing to remove them an encroachment on the interest after the interest was created?
No, sir, not in this case. The county never directed Mr. Meyer to remove the pavers, and they have been there.
You mean the person who has the lesser interest in the property can't enforce that interest directly?
His remedy would be to go through the county and ask for relief, which he never did here, Your Honor. Additionally, even if the pavers, if the Galvins had an actionable claim for Mr. Meyer's placement of the pavers, below the Meyers or the Galvins didn't prove these damages to a reasonable certainty. Rather, they put on Mr. Galvin's own self-serving testimony, and as the Jacqueline Washington Court held, this is not the best evidence, and this best evidence is not necessarily a rule of evidence like the best evidence rule. It's what is the best evidence to prove your damages, and here self-serving testimony is not that. There could have been an invoice, the architect's testimony.
Just because there's something else, why isn't it good enough?
Well, it's self-serving, Your Honor, and it's a speculation.
I don't have the faintest idea why my car works, but the law lets me testify to its value.
Right, Your Honor. But here, you know, even when Mr. Galvin did testify,
it's a lot better to have somebody who sells cars for a living there, or at least somebody that knows how to fix them, could say what was wrong with my car.
Right, and that's what should
have mean that I have to have those people. I get to get up even if I'm a blithering idiot. If I got the keys and a title, I can testify to what my cars were.
Right, that's true, Your Honor. But here, Mr. Galvin himself didn't even know what the property was. He was purely speculating. And at RP 801, 802, you can see that Mr. Galvin's lawyers are feeding him the testimony. And so under Jacqueline
well,
v. Washington,
do that. I mean, if it's improper, there's an evidentiary objection to be made.
Right, Your Honor.
That doesn't affect the ability of the judge to consider the words that are uttered. If the words shouldn't be uttered, then there's an evidentiary objection to be made. But if the words are uttered, the judge can consider them.
That's true, Your Honor. Also, the $10,000 in damages should be vacated for another reason, and that is during closing argument. Mr. Galvin's lawyer stood up and told the court, hey, if you enjoin Mr. Meyer, make him remove the pavers, then there's no damages. And that's exactly what the court did. They granted the injunction. Turning to the $14,265 in damages, these damages, too, weren't proven to a reasonable certainty. A notice of violation, Exhibit 71, actually shows that part of the waste that was allegedly disposed by Meyer onto the Galvin's property was placed there by the Galvins themselves. And also Mr. Jewell's testimony and his invoice relating to a question mark on the invoice, which was an estimate only, stated that he had no idea what the value would be because it was based on a weight, and he had no idea what that weight was. So his testimony at trial, Your Honors, was just pure speculation. Now I'd like to turn to the fees. RCW 424-630 is a one-way fee-shifting provision. It's very similar to the fee-shifting provision in the CPA, which the court in Sato has held as a one-way fee-shifting provision. As such, the Galvins can't recover any damages or fees they incurred in defending against our client's claim under 424-630. Additionally, the Galvins failed to address this argument, and it appears they may have conceded that argument in their briefing. Turning to CR 11, Your Honors, it applies only to pleadings, motions, and legal memorandum. In the court's order below, he failed to make the required explicit findings of how Mr. Meyer violated CR 11. He pointed to nothing showing how Mr. Meyer's pleading, namely his complaint, there was only one pleading filed here, violated CR 11. Because the court failed to make these explicit findings, this court's required rigorous review, you know, I think necessarily requires that, you know, the CR 11 award be vacated. The court pointed out certain paragraphs of the complaint that were alleged in bad faith. Those were paragraphs 2.5, 2.6, and 2.7. But nowhere, Your Honor, did the court make the required explicit findings of how those paragraphs violated CR 11. They were made on information and belief, and they were made to the best of our client's knowledge. Nowhere did Judge Urig tell my client how these paragraphs violated the rule.
If he said they were made in bad faith, and he made rulings that were adverse to the averments in those paragraphs, what's left?
Just the outcome of your claim, Your Honor, it doesn't dictate a CR 11.
Well, people lose all the time without being told that they lost in bad because they operated in bad faith.
Right.
Here we don't have a judge who just said you were in bad faith from the first time I set eyes on you, and you're still in bad faith as you're sitting there.
Right.
What he said was you were in bad faith, and these are the paragraphs that particularly ticked me off.
Right.
Well, if you've got factual findings that indicate that there wasn't factual support for those, for what's in those paragraphs, and you've got the judge singling out those paragraphs, it may not be the most artistic way of doing it in the world, but what's missing?
The how, Your Honor. How those paragraphs were made in bad faith. You know, they were made to the best of my client's knowledge, and so they're just not the required explicit findings. CR 11 is a very, you know, onerous sanction, and it shouldn't be taken lightly. And here, Judge Urg treated it more as a fee-shifting provision to kind of bootstrap his award under 424.630 and didn't make the explicit findings. And even if you take what Your Honor is saying, in that paragraph 2.5, 2.6, and 2.7 were made in bad faith, and the required explicit findings were made, that determination, those paragraphs were dismissed at motion for summary judgment. So the CR 11 clock stops there. It doesn't keep ticking through trial. And so for that reason alone, this award should be reversed or sent back to the commissioner or the trial court for a proper determination and a proper allocation of damages. Because the court's award just went too far and failed to even hinge on the causation requirement of CR 11. And for those reasons, Your Honor, we request that you vacate the damages and fees awarded below. Thank you.
Thank you. May it please the court, Roger Ellingson on behalf of the respondents, Mr. and Mrs. Galvin. I think the most important thing I need to do today is to distinguish Caldwell versus Etzel, in that it's relied upon by opposing counsel to argue that RCW 4.24.630 does not allow a recovery for damages of an interest in property as ruled in Standing Rock.
Your written brief didn't really speak much to
that, and I apologize for that. That's why I'm here to talk about it. We believe that the Caldwell versus Etzel decision is not dispositive because, first of all, their discussion and interpretation of 424.630 is dicta. And second, it's also based on a misunderstanding of the facts of Standing Rock. It's dicta because the court also found that there was no evidence in the record to support the trial court's finding of an intentional interference with Caldwell's use of the easement, and that's at 440. And they also found that the common enemy doctrine was an affirmative defense to Caldwell's claim. There's no reason, then, to address and interpret 424.630. They do it anyway, and I think it's important to understand that their own understanding of Standing Rock's facts is incorrect. Citing from the case at 438.39, in the current case, the trial court reasoned that Standing Rock, quote, supports the idea that it is not so much the, quote, trespass or, quote, entry upon the land of another, end of quote, but the wrongful invasion of a right in land that is protected by RCW 424.630. The trial court's analysis was supported by its determination that the decision in Standing Rock did not turn upon the entry upon the land of another, but instead, quote, upon the wrongful invasion of the real property interest held by the plaintiffs, as in this case, Standing Rock, in not having the easement leading to their property overburdened. A careful reading of the facts in Standing Rock refutes this reasoning. The easement was not leading to Standing Rock's property. It was located on Standing Rock's property and not located on another's land. And this is the important statement. The defendant wrongfully invaded Standing Rock's property, in parentheses, trespass, and repeatedly destroyed Standing Rock's gates on the easement he held. And they conclude, the statute's premise is that the defendant physically trespasses on the plaintiff's land. But in fact, their statement that he wrongfully invaded Standing Rock's property and trespassed is wrong. Quoting from Standing Rock at 235, quote, James Misich owns property in Ponderosa Pines. Ponderosa Pines owners have a road easement running through Standing Rock. As a consequence, Misich did not trespass on Standing Rock's property. And the gates were not located on Standing Rock's property. Quoting from Standing Rock at 236, quote, the northern gate, Standing Rock Gate, parenthetically, is permissively located on Mr. Pearson's property. The southern gate, Wenatchee Pines Gate, is permissively located on Wenatchee Pines. So it's clear from these facts that Misich legally entered the property of Standing Rock, assuming he crossed it, to get to the gate on Pearson's property, not on Standing Rock's property. That's what we have here today. We have
let's,
a situation.
Let's switch gears while we've got time. Let's talk about the fee and costs award.
Okay.
Can we determine from what we've been given what part of the award of fees and costs was awarded pursuant to 630?
Yes.
How?
Well, you mean the portion or that specific
the amount of money?
Not.
Okay. And the corollary would be we can't determine what amount was awarded pursuant to CR 11 then.
Correct.
Okay. Can we determine whether the amounts that were awarded based on the allegations that were dismissed at summary judgment, the award for those ended at the summary judgment period?
There were no attorneys awarded specifically for that, so we don't know.
So we don't know. Can we determine the effect of the $150 affirmative award,
yes,
on the single claim and as to whether or not that had an impact,
yes,
on fees or award? And how do we do that?
The court made a specific finding on that. At finding of fact number 13, it reads, if I may, the sum of $150 is a reasonable amount for plaintiff to finish properly pruning the tree. Plaintiff is not entitled to an attorney's fee or cost for establishing this amount, as the defendant prevailed on the issue of whether the pruning was permissive. Defendant stipulated that the tree was not properly pruned, and defendant prevailed on establishing the costs of proper repruning.
Okay, that determines that the opposing party doesn't get a fee or cost award. But does it factor out any part of your work on that issue, even if it was only $150 worth of an issue, that might have been part of a larger, unsegregated award of fees and costs? And in particular, I'm thinking of the arborist.
The testimony of the arborist was largely of defense for the remaining claim at trial, which was a timber trespass and also the regular waste trespass statute as well.
Did the arborist testify as to anything that had to do with the claim that resulted in the $150 award?
Yes, he did say $150, but I think also the plaintiff's expert admitted to $150 being inappropriate, although I can't cite the report of proceedings. Okay, so that's one sentence.
I really
one
well,
question, one sentence.
Well, and I offer this: the cost of litigating an attorney's fee award is itself compensable in the award. So it may be a pyrrhic victory in factoring out the amount that was affected by a $150 award for opposing counsel, but it may be a victory nonetheless. If we can't, don't we have to be clear that Judge Urich wasn't awarding your client costs
for defending against the claim that resulted in the $150 award, even if it was only part of the work that your arborist did?
Well, I believe that his finding, I mean, we admitted it, so
his
we didn't
finding
fight
is
it.
They don't get award, that they don't get award.
Right.
Right. It's not that your award should be diminished.
But we didn't fight the 150. We didn't defend against
the
150.
That's why I asked, did the arborist testify to it? Was there any part of his work that was associated with that which you gave up on or you stipulated to or whatever happened at trial?
Well,
your earlier answer to me was in the affirmative. If I misunderstood that, then go ahead and correct me.
Well, I mean, maybe I'm confused about it, but basically, they wanted the entire value of the tree trebled.
I get it.
Okay.
They didn't get that. They got $150.
Right, because we proved there was consent.
Right.
Okay, so we defeated their non-consensual thing. Then it came down to, well, what's going to cost to actually fix the improper pruning? That was the extent of it, $150.
So was that a separate trespass claim? That is,
he did not state it that way. He mentioned taking trees and sued us for, and I think I'm not sure whether I have the complaint here, but I would have to check it to make sure. But I do not believe it was that specific. In fact, I think my recollection is that I intended to argue that it was not a specific claim for one specific tree.
So if the fee award would be on the basis of you defending against that claim, that would come under Rule 11, presumably.
Yes.
Okay. But he prevailed $150 worth. So $150 worth wasn't without cause, wasn't inconsistent with an attorney's duties to sign a pleading. You can sign a pleading for a $150 claim, and it's not sanctionable. This is what I'm getting to. It may end up with the fees being shifted to the other side in terms of the cost of litigating an attorney fee award. But where do we find that wasn't part of that recovery? And it sounds to me like we probably won't find it from your exasperated expression.
It's so tiny.
I realize that.
We apply the de minimis rule to
this
as well.
You know, people settle things rather than give them to us. But when you come to us and say, we haven't been able to figure this out, I'm just here to tell you I'm from the government and I'm going to impose a ruling on you. So, I mean, now we are where we are. So.
And I'm not aware of any authority that requires the court. I guess I'm understanding where you're going. Are you saying you can see possibly remanding back for a description of what was defense, what was 424-630 claim, and then offset for the other?
Yeah.
It's a one-way statute. You both happen to have claims under the statute, but those claims go to your positive claims, not your defense costs. So unless those costs that are defensive fit under CR 11, how do we...
All defensive costs fit under CR 11. That's how it was handled. All the positive part was 624 or 424-630. That's what we prevailed on, and so I just combined them in the court's order, and apparently that was a mistake.
Yes,
thanks.
2 minutes.
Thank you. I'd like to focus my time on the damages. I think this court has grasped our arguments on the fees. Related to the 10,000 paver issue, like I said earlier,
you told me, I know you want to talk about damages, so I'm not going to let you. You told me the last time you were up here that there were fees awarded for pursuant to CR 11 on claims that ended at summary judgment.
Yes, sir.
What was that statement based on? Where do I find that?
Yes, sir. If you look at the court's order granting defendant's motion for partial summary judgment, that starts at page 25 in the record. The actual findings are on page 26, Your Honor. He goes through and he dismisses, and starting really in paragraphs 3 through okay. 4.
I get that. The next step. How do I tie that together with the fee award to determine that he awarded fees that went beyond that on those claims?
He awarded all fees to the Galvins from start to finish.
Well, but did they incur fees on those claims after they won on summary judgment?
Related to those. No, Your Honor, I don't think so. I think the clock would have stopped.
So then what was wrong with what he did, as far as that goes, then?
He awarded, so if the CRO,
I had understood your argument to be these parts of the dispute ended at summary judgment. But nevertheless, after we tried other things, fees that were a part of that, that were incurred after they won on summary judgment, were awarded. And that would be wrong because that part of the dispute was over.
That's correct, Your Honor. I misspoke. They did incur fees subsequent to the motion for summary judgment ruling.
On those issues?
On all issues, Your Honor.
Well, I don't know what you're telling me when you say all issues. And I'll have to figure it out.
Thank you. Next up is White versus Jack.